This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn.
And I'm John Davis. In this special edition of Gulf Coast Live, we're beginning a year-long effort called Where is Home? Haitians Counting Down. Temporary protected status is the mechanism by which people running from natural disaster or armed conflict in other countries can legally work and live in the United States.
Right now, people from Haiti, El Salvador, Syria, Nepal, Honduras, Yemen, Somalia, Sudan, Nicaragua, and South Sudan have temporary protected status. We're focusing on Haiti because in Lee and Collier counties, we have just under 3,000 Haitians here on TPS, and their deadline to return to their home country is in 1 year.
Florida as a whole is home to more Haitians than anywhere else in the country, and according to the Center for Migration Studies, 32,000 live here. 18,800 children have been born to these TPS holders in Florida, meaning their kids are American-born.
With headlines about parent and child separations at the border, the specter of deportation becomes that much more frightening for people who've lived here for almost a decade. Last week, at an informal meeting on the ending of TPS, WGCU talked with some of the people shining a light on the issue.
Here are the concerns of three women: Beatrice Jacquette Castor, president of the Haitian American Democratic Club of Lee County; Ilamis Alexander, who was there offering information to the Haitian community about TPS expiring; and immigration attorney Indira Demean.
Well, right now we're scared, anxious. The Haitian community just does not know what's going to happen because it is subject to end as of July 22nd, 2019. So therefore, we don't know what's going to happen. So therefore, we hope that with the election that's happening, that Democrats will win the Senate House in order to be able to have lawmakers that are going to be able to provide another program for the Haitian people.
Right now it's just uncertain, fear of going back home to a country that they've left so many years ago, to a country right now, unfortunately, that is very unstable, not having the resources back home, and also fear of losing, of breaking the families apart, you know, just the fact that a child can stay behind and the parents don't know who they're going to be with, and then just going back home, that separation, it's basically heartbroken. They're doing their part, they're working, they're paying their taxes, they're paying their bills, they're doing what they are helping America to be where America is today. They are doing the dirtiest jobs in order to provide for their families, not just the one here. When a Haitian is working, they're not just working to pay the bills here, but they're also helping the families left in Haiti. So it's very sad that, you know, that the people in government do not see that.
Right now, the best thing that our people need to do is make sure the Haitians that are U.S. citizens and promote the democratic values in getting people out to vote for this election, because this election is very critical to the Haitian American community of Southwest Florida, the East Coast as well, Miami, Fort Lauderdale, Boynton Beach, including Orlando. There are 58,000 Haitians that are affected by TPS.
So they don't have a lot of time. And, you know, there's been talks about, you know, a more permanent solution to the problem. However, it's just talk and nothing solid has been done. So what I am advising clients to do is have things in place, mechanisms in place. If you are deported tomorrow, who's going to take care of your children? What is going to happen to your assets here in the United States? You know, have those things in place just in case it happens tomorrow.
That was Beatrice Jacquet Castor, Ilamis Alexandra, and Indira Dameen speaking at an event last week in Fort Myers at the Heavenly Canaan Baptist Church. The music is a song called Se Papudat by Haitian-American artist Alain Cave.
In order to more fully understand the current situation in Haiti, first we're delving deep into the country's past and exploring connections between current conditions on the island and events that occurred as far back as the 17th century, before the successful slave revolt that ultimately led to the founding of Haiti as a sovereign nation. In order to shed some light on that history, I recently spoke with Dr. Philippe Gérard. He's a professor of Caribbean history at McNeese State University in Lake Charles, Louisiana, and author of The Memoirs of Toussaint Louverture. Professor Gérard has studied and published extensively about the life and impact of Toussaint Louverture, who led that successful 1791 slave rebellion in what was then the French colony of Saint-Domingue. I caught up with Professor Gérard in Paris via Skype. We began our conversation with a look at what led the Spanish to cede the western portion of Hispaniola to France in the first place.
The Spanish initially controlled the whole of the island, which they called Hispaniola, meaning the Spanish island. They had hoped to find some access to Asia. Of course, they realized quickly they were mistaken. Then they hoped to look for gold, and they found very little in Hispaniola. They tried to exploit the Tainos for work, for sugar, and so forth, but they died of mistreatment and disease fairly quickly. So after about 20, 30 years, the Spanish moved on to more promising riches in Mexico and Peru, and essentially the island became uninhabited by and large. With the exception of Santo Domingo, which is the capital to the east and is still the capital of the Dominican Republic. That's what left the opening for the French to move in the 17th century after the Spanish had kind of evacuated the island and killed off the native population. A number of French adventurers, we would call them buccaneers today, came to the western part of Hispaniola initially to do some hunting. That's what the buccaneers were. Boucan in the local language is a barbecue. And they would sell that to local passing ships and then realize that since they were gifted with guns and there were a lot of rich ships passing by, they figured they might make more money off piracy than off French cuisine. And that's how the buccaneers became pirates, as we call them today. And right. Eventually the French were so dominant in western Hispaniola that Spain had to recognize their presence. And there was a treaty in 1697, Treaty of Ryswick, that officially ceded the western one-third of Hispaniola to France, and they transformed Santo Domingo in Spanish into Saint-Domingue, the French version, and that's what we call today Haiti.
And French colonists, perhaps aside from the buccaneers, were the ones who first created sugarcane plantations there, and then I imagine sparked, you know, the first slaves being brought from Africa.
Yes, initially the first French settlers were purely buccaneers, so only made money off ravaging the Spanish Empire. But in the longer term, they established a more lasting economic model, which was, as you mentioned, based on the exploitation of tropical crops, sugarcane, coffee, tobacco, indigo, cocoa, with sugar and coffee being the two more prominent. The issue was labor, because sugarcane required a lot of laborers, the Taino population having been wiped out by the Spanish, and it was necessary to bring in labor either from Europe. And some European workers came, but many of them fell victim to yellow fever. And the third option, unfortunately, was to bring African laborers under the slave trade. And it's really in the 18th century and the French rule that a slave trade to Haiti really picked up. Ultimately, you had about 1 million Africans that were forcibly brought to what is today Haiti, which would be even more than the number of slaves brought to the United States by comparison.
And I imagine that this would have led up to, you know, what we know regarding Toussaint Louverture. His father was one of those slaves who was brought over from West Africa.
That's correct. Toussaint Louverture was, or Louverture as it's pronounced in English.
Okay.
Would have been about, Toussaint Louverture himself was born in Haiti around 1743. Both his parents came from the kingdom of Alada that would correspond to present-day Benin. In the west coast of Africa. They were brought both through the Atlantic slave trade. Unfortunately, we have very, very few details about how they came, why, which year, which ship, the reason being that information about individual slaves is very limited. All we know about them is through family traditions that were passed on through the Louverture family, and these are not always accurate.
Yeah, that's, I imagine that's got to be a frustrating gap in historical documents for somebody like you, just given that so much was not written down or documented about slaves. They were kind of disregarded, overlooked.
That's correct. I've spent a lot of time in the archives in France, which are very rich, but virtually all of them are written by planters. So for the colonial period, you have endless lists of accounting and so forth, where slaves only appear by their name, ethnic origin, their age, their craft, and that's about it. And right below them, you have cattle with the same kind of information. So they're essentially tools in the productive process. It's very rare that you have more information about where they came from, their aspirations, their drama, and so forth. Most of that is forgotten. In the case of the Louverture family, there's more than that. When Toussaint Louverture himself became important during the Revolution, and he learned how to read and write, he could have documented the past about his own family. But for reasons that are not altogether clear, he erased that from his own past. We have access to an important memoir that he wrote at the very end of his life to retrace his career. And I remember being very excited when I first came across that memoir, thinking, here is a story of the life of Toussaint Louverture written by the man himself, and I'm going to learn everything about his past. And in the entire document, there's only one sentence that describes his past. He says, I was a slave. I acknowledge it. And that's the extent of the first 50 years of his life before the Revolution. So the element, I think, of maybe a shame in his part, or desire not to revisit those painful moments of his past. And that's part of the reason, too, why we know so little about his ancestry.
Do we believe that he wrote this account while he was imprisoned in France by Napoleon?
Yes, that's during that period. We're kind of jumping to the end of his career.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, we'll go back.
In the Asian Revolution, the very end of it, Napoleon sent a vast expedition to overthrow him, which was successful in capturing Toussaint Louverture. And he was sent to what is called the Fort Aujou. It's in the eastern part of France next to Switzerland. And he spent a miserable few months there. In part, he used that time to write an account of his life, hoping that this would mollify Napoleon a bit. It did not. But the document is authentic. It is in his own handwriting. It was found on his body when he died. There's no doubt about his authenticity.
And I think I may have, you know, done our listeners a disservice by sort of jumping to the end of his life. But I was hoping you could kind of give us a timeline of Louverture's shifting alliances once he became this military leader. I understand first he fought for the Spanish against the French, then for France against Spain and Great Britain, and finally for Saint-Domingue against Napoleon. Tell us more about this and what motivated these shifting alliances.
He is indeed a conflicting character. It's difficult to know what he really meant or thought. I've read hundreds and thousands of letters by him, but sometimes he will write three letters on the same day to three different people, telling very convincingly three different things that are not compatible with one another. And he may have truly meant a fourth one that was kept deep within himself. So it's sometimes difficult to know what he truly believed in, and that's what makes him such a fascinating character. As far as what we can piece together, as I told you, he was born around 1743, so he lived as a slave for most of his life. But we also know that in the 1770s, he obtained freedom for himself, or at least de facto freedom. So he, after that, was able to exploit some other laborers, some of whom were enslaved, which always surprises people to know that before the Revolution, he had been on both sides of the slavery divide, enslaved, but also benefiting from slave labor after he was freed. That meant that when the slave revolt began in Haiti in 1791, he was a bit on the fence for a while, hiding his involvement quite a bit for fear that the slave revolt might fail. He seems to have been present from the beginning, but very much in the shadows, waiting for things to unfold and make sure that the slave revolt would succeed. Keep in mind that every slave revolt in the Caribbean at that point had failed, ever. And the penalties for those who failed, according to 18th century justice, were just downright horrendous. So I think it was just out of self-preservation that he stayed in the shadows. So initially, he fought against the French planters. Later on, Spain being present nearby in what is today the Dominican Republic, he was able to ally himself with the Dominican Republic and be accepted by the Spanish into the Spanish army with a grade of colonel. So he fought for a year or so under Spanish, on the Spanish side. Later on, as the French Revolution grew more radical, the French government decided to accept the abolition of slavery in 1794, which meant that Toussaint Louverture himself, after that, decided to join the French Revolutionary Army now that he was committed to abolition. So that's when he switched sides one more time, betrayed the Spanish, and joined the French Revolution. That's the time when he really reached his apex. He was very successful in kicking out the Spanish invaders. The English also tried to invade Haiti. He kicked them out. And eventually, by the end of the 1790s, he was the sole ruler of what is today Haiti, general, governor for life, widely admired around the world, and often compared to Napoleon as being the Black Napoleon, which is, in fact, what eventually led to some troubles for him, because the white Napoleon, the one from France, grew concerned that Toussaint Louverture might set himself up for independence and might be a rival to France itself. And so that's when Napoleon sent a massive expedition to Haiti to overthrow Toussaint Louverture, capturing him, and that's how he died in captivity in France in 1803. He actually died right before the Haitian Revolution. He never quite saw the end of that conflict and the dawn of Haitian independence.
Yeah, it was just under a year before you know the sovereign nation of Haiti was officially announced. I think he died in April, and then January of the next year is when that actually occurred. Correct?
That's correct. Again, he was a character who was very cautious. So even though he acted as if Haiti was independent, he never took the step of actually formally declaring independence for fear that this might create some troubles with France. For that reason, technically, he died as a French citizen, still as a general of the French army, wearing a French uniform. He died right 1 year before Haiti became independent. We spoke earlier about how a lot of the archives from Haiti are now in France. There's also a battle over the memory of Toussaint Louverture and whether he should be a French hero or a Haitian hero. He died in captivity in France. His body is still there. We're not exactly sure where, but it's in France. And so many Haitians have asked for the body to be repatriated, thinking he is our national hero. He should now be laid to rest in Haiti itself. And France has been reluctant to send the body back, in part because we don't know exactly where it is, but also because the French people will now look at him as being a French national hero.
And, you know, just his attitude towards slavery itself is so complicated. You know, here's someone who grew up most of his life a slave, and then was later known to own or rent slaves himself, as he had, and then later he, I understand, betrayed an anti-slavery conspiracy in Jamaica because it served a more narrow purpose regarding the emancipation of slaves in Saint-Domingue. And ultimately, he wound up restoring the slave trade in Saint-Domingue after having abolished it because, I think, as you said earlier, the plantations needed workers. Can you give us much of a psychological picture of – and I know it's impossible to jump inside the head of somebody, you know, who died all that time ago. But, I mean, what kind of insights have you gained about his attitude towards slavery given a lot of these contradictory actions?
Well, his biography gives us some insight into his attitude on slavery. He was born during the era of slavery in Haiti, which was awful for a lot of the field slaves. And he witnessed some horrible executions, people being burnt alive or broken on the wheel. He saw that himself. On the other hand, because he was able to obtain a more favored task, which was to take care of the plantation's horses and such, he never suffered from slavery quite as much as some of his contemporaries did. And again, after that, he was freed himself. So he had a slightly more positive experience during slavery than some of the other people who would have been his contemporaries. And that informed his attitude during the revolution. He wanted to break free from slavery, but still maintain the plantation system that had existed and had made the colony rich. Initially, when the slaves were freed by themselves and then by France around 1793-94, there was a big mystery around the world. Could that work? Many philosophers had called for freedom, but the more racist planners had said it never will work because Africans, if you don't enslave them, they won't work. So everybody was looking at Haiti as a test model of whether freedom could work in practice, because that was the first colony to emancipate its slaves. And people like Toussaint Louverture were very disappointed because most of the field workers, once they were freed, left the plantations in droves and tried to set up some kind of small subsistence farms in the mountains. And the plantation system of Haiti that had been the most flourishing in the world collapsed virtually overnight. And so when Toussaint Louverture tried to rebuild the plantation system, part of it is because he's a conservative figure who thinks that people should work. And by that point, he had acquired land himself, so he wanted to enrich himself. But there's an abolitionist side to it, which is to show to the world that the freedom of the black race can function, and that all the pro-slavery activists were wrong, that he could create a functional society governed by black people like himself. So what he did was always to look for a middle road. He was committed to the abolition of slavery, banned the use of the whip, for example, the idea of selling and buying people like chattel. On the other hand, he wanted the plantations to work and could be extremely harsh toward the workers who did not want to be part of his system, forced them to continue working, and even, as you mentioned, tried to import more laborers from Africa, which would have involved dealing with some unsavory figures, British slave traders mostly. But those workers then, once brought to Haiti, would have been given a semi-free status and not been formally enslaved. You mentioned also that business of the slave revolt in Jamaica, which the French government was trying to export the Haitian Revolution overseas, to Jamaica in particular. Toussaint Louverture himself opposed it and eventually betrayed that revolt because he thought that for the Haitian slave revolt to function, you could not rock the boat too much, so to speak. You could not get make enemies of all the neighbors, especially a powerful country like Britain. So he thought it would be better to have a revolution in one country alone to make it work in Haiti. And then we would deal with the abolition of slavery in British Highlands and so forth much, much later on. But in the short term, it was important to get the British and the Americans and all the slave-owning neighbors on his side. So there's a lot of gray areas in his policies, to make it simple.
Do we know much about Louverture's religious beliefs? I would have imagined he was Catholic, but was that something that was important to him? Do you think that's something that influenced his ideology and his decisions?
There has been a lot of debate over his beliefs. Catholicism and voodoo would have been the two main religions of his time. Catholicism being imported through the Spanish and later the French and being the official religion of the state. And voodoo being a combination, a syncretic faith based on religions practiced by the slaves in Africa and then mixed in with some of the Catholic practices. The difficulty in guessing what religion people follow is that voodoo had a bad reputation as being the religion of the slaves from Africa. So people might practice one religion or even both, but always hid the fact that they practice voodoo. For that reason, scholars have been very mixed as to whether Toussaint Louverture practiced one or the other, or both. In my research, he came across as a very strong, devout Catholic. I mentioned earlier that the slave registers that you find on plantations describing who is owned by the planter. One of the earliest ones found from the plantation in which Toussaint Louverture was a slave actually has some notations next to each slave to give a few important facts about that person's personality. And next to the name of Toussaint, it was not known as Toussaint Louverture yet, just Toussaint, they make a point of specifying he is very devout and he spends a lot of time trying to proselytize and convert other people to the Catholic faith. And of the 150 slaves on the plantation, he was the only one describing those terms. So I'm convinced that from an earlier age, he was a devout Catholic.
Interesting. Do we know if he ever took any formal steps to delegitimize the practice of voodoo, or was it just something that he didn't really talk about?
He did talk about it. The reason being that voodoo to him was a religion associated with people born in Africa as opposed to Creole slaves born in the Caribbean, like he had been, and also a religion that he associated with revolt. Many of the people that refused to accept the plantation system happened to be followers of voodoo. So in the 1790s, when Toussaint Louverture was at the top as governor general of the island, he took formal legislation to try to ban nightly rituals of possession, voodoo rites. And when he set up a constitution for Haiti in 1801, he formally made the Catholic religion the state religion of Haiti.
Yeah, apropos of nothing, I found it surprising to learn several years ago that actually the practice of voodoo and what you were just talking about regarding possession, the whole concept of the zombie genre and how big that's blown up in Western countries in recent years actually has its roots in colonial Haiti with the practice of voodoo and slaves living in French plantations.
That's correct. In Haitian folklore, a zombie would be somebody who has been put under a spell or maybe has absorbed some poison and so will be buried alive, so to speak, or will continue to act and behave almost like a robot, a beast that is controlled by the person that has cast the spell. Some scholars who have studied that at greater depths than I have think it might be a metaphor for slavery itself, that the slaves of the colonial era, in effect, were zombies. They were under the a spell of a more powerful person that treated them as beasts, as chattel, and could tell them what to do. Mm-hmm. If you ever encounter a zombie, I can give you some practical advice. Maybe your listeners will find that useful.
Okay.
It's supposed to give them a taste of salt, and that will awaken the zombies from their slumber. So that's something that you can take with you as the one useful piece of information I gave you today.
All right. Yeah, I'm definitely going to keep one of those little salt packets in my pocket from now on. and this is jumping ahead quite a bit here, but we know that in modern day Haiti, soil erosion and deforestation have led to significant problems when it comes to Haiti getting hit by natural disasters. You know, you have periodic flooding, where mudslides occur and are perhaps more significantly damaging than they would be if the country still had a lot of those natural resources, its trees. And I've read that Haiti's forest covered some 60% of the country as recently as half a century ago. And I'm just curious if, you know, the motivations that led to these modern day problems when it comes to a lack of natural resources and deforestation really began back in the time of Toussaint Louverture, or if that was something that came much later.
No, the first roots of that go back to the French colonial period. When the French took over Haiti, it was largely uninhabited because the native population had been wiped out and the Spanish had largely left. So the early Buccaneers, they would go and hunt wild game in what were essentially primeval forests. But as the French settled in Haiti, they cut all the trees from the level areas, the plains, that were conducive to sugarcane plantations. And by the mid to late 18th century, they moved increasingly into the hills because these are the areas where you can grow coffee, which was the big cash crop by the late 18th century. And already in the sources of the 1770s and 80s, you start hearing from French settlers who are complaining that the soil is becoming bare after a few years of cultivation of coffee because you have cut up all the trees and soil erosion is an issue. So that's an issue already there. It's only gotten worse since independence, mostly due to overpopulation. Haiti had about 600,000 people when the Haitian Revolution began. The revolution was so devastating that through war deaths, epidemics, or just immigration, you only had half that at independence, about 300,000. So at that point, Haiti was rather empty still when it was born. Jump forward to today, from 300,000 people, we now have about 10 million people in Haiti, 30 times that number. So obviously, with most Haitians being farmers of some type, there's been a lot of pressure to move into the hillsides, cut all the trees that are there, just to get more land for your children and the next generation and the next generation. And in a tropical climate, whenever you cut trees at the next tropical downpour, the land will be washed away. And as you mentioned, that makes the island very susceptible to any kind of hurricane or flooding, both in the hills or at the bottom of the valley.
You know, I wanted to ask as a final question, is it possible to imagine Haiti today without Toussaint Louverture? I mean, is there any singular character in history who was more influential into the shaping of modern Haiti?
Well, when you talk about history, you're supposed to be impartial. When you talk to me about Toussaint Louverture, I must say that I leave aside some of my own professional impartiality. I spent enough time with him reading his correspondence and such that I have developed a strong bond to the person. And I cannot obviously imagine Haiti without him. He has become a great hero to Haitians. Right after independence, people were kind of ambivalent about him because he had been such a stern ruler. So some people resented the iron fist that he had used. But if you jump forward to today, he is, by and large, the great national hero of Haiti. If you land in Port-au-Prince, the name of the airport would be Toussaint Louverture. He will be everywhere in the schools, in the name of avenues and such, to the point where it's difficult to talk about him. I've given talks about Toussaint Louverture in Haiti, and he's been so mythologized that people cannot accept that you would say anything that's bad about him. Every human being has a share of gray areas within him, and Toussaint Louverture was definitely one of those figures that was complicated. But if a person like myself, especially being a white Frenchman, shows up in Haiti to say, well, by the way, Toussaint Louverture did this and that was not as glorious as the rest of his career, he will be very poorly received because he is the great founder of Haiti. Especially with the country after independence not doing so well economically or politically, the era of the revolution, all the great heroes from that time, the Jean-Jacques Dessalines, the Henri Christophe, the Toussaint Louverture, these are the great men of Haiti's history. And if you try to chip away a slightest bit at their greatness, it's as if you are destroying Haiti itself. Another piece of practical advice, I guess, for your listeners, if you go to Haiti, don't you dare say anything bad about Toussaint Louverture.
I will keep
and carry salt with you.
All right. I will keep those in mind. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us. I really appreciate it.
And that was my pleasure. Thank you.
That was my conversation with McNeese State University professor of Caribbean history and author of The Memoirs of Toussaint Louverture, exploring Haiti's early history and its connections with current conditions on the island today.
And if you're just joining the show, we're talking about Haiti, its past and present, as we begin a year-long project looking at the people here in Southwest Florida who will be impacted by the ending of temporary protected status in July of next year. It's called Where is Home? Haitians Counting Down.
That status designation came about in response to the 7.0 magnitude earthquake of 2010. It hit just 16 miles outside of the heavy populated capital city of Port-au-Prince. More than 2.5 million people live in the metro area of Port-au-Prince. 300,000 were killed. Hundreds of thousands of homes were destroyed or damaged. And the devastation rippled into Southwest Florida, where already a Haitian population had settled.
And John, you were there at Hope for Haiti headquarters in Naples right after the earthquake and filed an excellent story. It was really interesting listening to how hectic things were. And then the BBC happened to be here doing a World Have Your Say show. And then the earthquake happened. Tell me about that experience.
So the earthquake happened on January 12th. The very next day on the 13th, the BBC's World Have Your Say goes live in our studios. It's been less than 24 hours since the earthquake. Our audience is filled with members of Southwest Florida's Haitian community. Definitely one of the most tense, I think, effective hours of radio I've ever been a part of producing. And people were just looking for information. Of course, you know, the telecommunication infrastructure, which is completely destroyed. We were able to connect with a woman running an orphanage in Port-au-Prince named Dixie Bickle. And so she's connecting directly with members of our audience saying, you know, my family lives in this neighborhood. And just hearing Dixie tell them, you know, I'm sorry, there's nothing left standing in that neighborhood.
That had to be incredible. And the mayhem just after that earthquake, it's really hard to grasp. And then the lengths to which the country's gone since then to repair and rebuild, it can't be taken lightly. I talked earlier today with the current CEO of Hope for Haiti, Skylar Badenoch. He was there the day of that earthquake, and he said at the time that he thought it would take at least 20 years for the country to rebuild. And here we are almost 9 years later. He gives us an idea of what Haiti is like today. You were there when the earthquake hit. Were you there?
So I was down in Haiti. I flew down to Haiti the day before the earthquake. I was going down there to break ground on a couple of schools. We were building some schools in two rural communities. I was with another organization, and I was living at the Hope for Haiti guest house. They were a good partner of ours. So when the earthquake hit, it was like 4:53 in the afternoon. I was sitting inside, and you know, I was about 100 kilometers away, but we still felt it. It felt like a pretty good size earthquake. And then we learned later that the epicenter was much closer to Port-au-Prince near Carrefour in Haiti. And then information started trickling in that night, and we quickly learned that it was a much larger disaster than we had originally thought.
So did you run towards the epicenter there to try to help?
Well, we gave it some thought. I mean, we didn't want to just run in and try to help without knowing what we were going to do. So we waited a day. And then the day after, we were preparing our cars, and we headed into Port-au-Prince. It was about the day after, the 2 days after, and we ended up in a tent city of about 10,000 people in Carrefour, and we slept there for about a month, and we opened up a health clinic and helped treat as many people as we could. But you know, there were about 300,000 people who had died, and then probably another 250,000 who were injured. And so even if you helped 100 people, it was just scratching the surface of what needed to be done at that time.
It was huge. Now, did you ever come into contact with any people who were considering coming to the United States on TPS, or did you ever hear anybody, you know, weighing their options of what to do, whether to stay, whether to go?
I actually didn't. That was something that just didn't, it wasn't at the top of our minds at that time. We were really just focused on how do we help the country recover, and how do we help people who really suffered incredible shock and tremendous amount of suffering? How do we help them? How do we help ease the pain and help people recover? That was really what we were focusing on. And we didn't get too involved in the TPS issue at all as an organization.
Yeah, I just didn't know if you had heard people maybe talking about some of their options and what they were.
We do know that a lot of people who are in Haiti have ties to the United States. And so when you think about the earthquake and you think about the devastation and destruction, it really reached more than just Port-au-Prince and the provinces. It had a ripple effect to families in the United States who had to help their family members back in Haiti pick up the pieces. And so it had a lot more impact geographically than just the epicenter.
Because the Haitian diaspora just goes so far.
Yeah, it
really reaches into a lot of communities.
Absolutely.
So we heard a lot last week at an informational meeting about people who are here on TPS. We heard a lot of people talking about people that are in the United States sending money and wages back to Haiti. Do you see or hear a lot about that?
That is absolutely something we hear a lot about. Remittances are one of the number one sources of income for many Haitian people. And that money sent back is so critical to the development of Haiti and to people who are living in Haiti, because it helps pay and supplement, subsidize school fees, pays for a lot of construction. It pays for sometimes food and healthcare. And so it is a crucial part of Haitian development. There are the remittances sent home from family members who are living in the United States or abroad.
Yeah, it's interesting. I was looking at statistics before I came in to talk with you, and it seems like Haiti's unemployment rate is 14%, and that's the official number. Does that sound about right to you, 14% unemployed? Or because what I'm hearing from people from Haiti that are talking to me, they seem to feel that it's much higher.
Yeah, I would say that unemployment is probably a little bit higher than that, just based off my knowledge. However, if you are considering the informal sector, that might be why it seems a little bit lower, because everybody's working. It's just their jobs are different.
And working under the table,
so
maybe?
If they're in the informal sector and that's accounted, then maybe that's why it's around 14%.
Yeah, no, I was just curious, but it's also how employed are you? Because the wages would be different. I mean, if somebody's employed, what are they making?
Right. Well, yeah, and that I think that just speaks to the GDP per capita income in Haiti, and we know that's pretty low, anywhere between $800 and $1,000 a year on average, and so you're right. So unemployment rate, I think that's sometimes it's a misleading data point. Because there's underemployment, and then also there's poverty. There's the poverty line, and I think what we look at Hope for Haiti is the poverty line. We try to focus on helping people who are suffering from extreme poverty. That's people who are living underneath $1.25 a day.
Yeah, I was looking at those numbers too. 81% of the Haitians under TPS in Florida are employed, 78% of them are above the poverty level, but that's the U.S. poverty level, which is going to be different from Haiti, where they were saying that 59% of people live on less than $2 a day. So what your version of poverty is very different place to place.
That's correct. And I've heard the extreme poverty rate in Haiti is somewhere around 50%, which is people living under about $1.25 a day. That's extreme poverty.
So what's Haiti like now? I mean, we know of the earthquake, but we don't really get a whole lot of headlines that tell us much of the positive news. In the United States, we hear about riots that broke out in the beginning of or in the middle of July about the fuel price increase, but that's the only news we get. And when I talked with you on the phone earlier, you indicated there's a lot more positive news going on there, but it's just smaller scale.
Well, yeah, and we just try to say this. The challenges are real. And we know that the challenges in Haiti exist, the economic poverty, the natural disasters, the political unrest, a very long history of pretty disastrous foreign policy towards the country. We know those challenges exist, but that only tells part of the story. The other side of the story is that Haiti is a country of resilient, talented, educated, hardworking people, with a beautiful culture, with beautiful coastlines and geography. We've seen how hard our Haitian staff work to improve their own country. And when we drive the streets in the morning and we see parents taking their kids to school with the same hope that we have when we take our kids to school in the US for our children, for a better life, we see that there's a lot of similarities between both cultures, and we see that there's a lot of similarities in humanity. And so there are so many beautiful things about Haiti, and there's so much, I think, hope that exists within the country that as an organization and a network of people who care deeply about Haiti, we tend to try to tell the story from all sides and in a holistic way, because we know that the story is nuanced, and the story, of course, like I said, involves challenges, but it also involves things that are beautiful, things that are successful, things that work, people who care, people who work hard. And that's the narrative that we subscribe to as an organization.
And I'm wondering where corruption falls into this, because I think that when there is or has been systemic corruption politically from the top down, it tends to have an impact on people all the way through the chain, all the way down to the poorest individual in the country, where it kind of fosters a lack of trust in a system or the possibility of having success. However, that being said, I talked with another person who had been in Haiti for 25 years working with a nonprofit. He told me that he feels like at this moment, not particularly this month, but in this year, he's felt like things have been more positive and individuals have felt a little bit more positive than he had seen them in the past. Have you seen a bit of a tide change? I mean, obviously this past month with the price hike on the gas, which was then reversed, that was a hiccup in the process, obviously a big hiccup. But do you see that maybe on the individual level, people are feeling a little bit more hopeful for the ability to individually create a change?
Yeah, so I would respond to that question with three points. The first is that I remember flying into Haiti the day before the earthquake. And I remember specifically thinking, wow, there's a lot of positive movement. There's a lot of positive feeling going on in the country. You can feel education improving. You can see it. You can tell that the economy is doing better. That people are doing better. And then the earthquake happened like the next day, and so that was a very very drastic change from what we were feeling just days before the earthquake. I would say that feeling hasn't completely returned, where people who know the country and people who work in the country feel that it's that same feeling of economic and social progress as before the earthquake. But I will say that things have been improving gradually. And so I think that's an important point to make is yes, And then is things are improving. And then as far as corruption goes, we know that corruption exists almost in every government in the world. There's not a society or a government that exists that doesn't have or struggle with corruption. Haiti is included in that. And so what we try to do, we think is really important, is to seek out political leaders, either at the local level. For us, it's typically at the local level, who are interested in working and improving their country. And we've been able to find those people. We found them in mayor's offices. We found them at local ministries of health and education and the water ministry. They've been great partners for us. And we think that that's an important story to tell in the face of the narrative that people like to say that Haiti is a very corrupt country. And so we've had some success. My answer is that there's corruption in Haiti, but there's also there are good people who are interested in making ethical and strong decisions to support their country.
It sounds like it's of a bottom-up approach instead of top-down.
And I think you could put it that way. And just the third point that I would make is that this government seems to have been doing a better job in engaging different provinces and different local leaders in not just economic development but infrastructure development. So they've been working. I know this recent government has been really working hard to develop infrastructure to help rebuild roads and show that they're out there making an effort. And I've seen that. Our road to our infirmary just got paved last year, and that was something that has been on our minds for half a decade. And so it's nice to see that kind of progress and people spending the people's money to improve the country.
And I've been hearing that from other people, that some roads are getting paved, and that helps buoy people's belief in the ability of things getting done. And one of the things that you've emphasized a number of times is that the recovery from that earthquake is something that is eventual. It takes a time. It takes a while for things to get better.
Oh, totally. And when I drove into Port-au-Prince, two days, maybe a day and a half after the earthquake, the first thing that I thought was, this is a 20-year disaster, because it was apocalyptic and government buildings had fallen. Some of the most important infrastructure in the country had been destroyed. And so in my eyes, I immediately thought, well, this is going to take 20 years to come back to this point. And we're almost 10 years in. Thing that I think about when, I think about the earthquake and the recovery is, people often ask me, well, is it even any better? And I always laugh. So I'm like, well, if you saw it, the day after, then you would say absolutely yes, because it couldn't have got much worse than that day.
Yeah.
And the day after, and days following the earthquake. And so gradually, yeah, things are getting better. People are rebuilding. And I have to make this point that it's largely the Haitian people who are responsible for reconstruction and rebuilding. I can't stress that enough. And when I think of the people who were the first responders of the earthquake were Haitians, the Haitian people. They were there and they were digging their family members out of the rubble, and they were responding before anybody else got there. And they're also the ones, and we believe this, that the development and the social and economic growth of Haiti depends mostly on the Haitian people. And so our role at Hope for Haiti is to just help support that and help our team, who are comprised of mostly Haitians, help them make a positive difference in their own country. And that's what I feel like my role is, and our role is, we focus a lot of our work on raising awareness and raising funds in the United States.
It's interesting how devastating that earthquake was, that we actually only have 52,000 Haitians here in the United States on TPS as a result of that earthquake. You would think that it might have even been higher. So it does kind of stand as like kind of a testament to the people to stick around and rebuild.
I, I think so too. You know, when I talk to a lot of my Haitian friends, they are really interested in staying and being a part of the solution in Haiti. And I think this is an interesting movement too, Julie, that you see a lot more of the diaspora coming back, getting involved, trying to find ways that they can make a positive impact for education and the economy and healthcare. And that's a positive movement. And that is definitely something I've noticed more and more. And it wasn't as, I think, profound as it was even before the earthquake. So I think that's a positive trend that I'm really interested in following.
And I'm wondering what's going to happen with the people that are here that are on TPS, who may have gone to school, gone to college. They may be coming back with nursing degrees or other degrees that they might not have otherwise gotten or tried to achieve. And they're going to be then going back to Haiti, maybe, depending on what happens with the ending of TPS in 1 year from now. I wonder what that influx of people, what kind of impact that would have on Haiti in the future, too.
Well, my guess would be if it's a largely skilled and educated population who are returning with new ideas and a advanced skill set, then that would be positive for Haiti and Haiti's economy. And so, yeah, that would be exciting. And I think if there's a way to tap into that kind of knowledge and different skill sets to help promote business and help promote opportunities, I think that would be a positive thing for Haiti and the people of Haiti.
So what is Hope for Haiti working on right now?
So Hope for Haiti runs comprehensive development programs that are proven to reduce poverty. We do that in the southern part of Haiti in 24 partner communities. So what we do is we overlay 5 core programmatic areas that focus on education, healthcare, infrastructure development, clean water, access to clean water, and then economic development. And through those core programs, our model helps these communities reduce absolute poverty. So that's those people who are living on $1.25 a day. And so we've been doing that for the last 30 years, and we've had some very strong metrics that should indicate that as we invest in these 5 core programmatic areas, that we're able to reduce the likelihood of people living on $1.25 a day. And so we have 51 Haitian staff who are working every single day to execute on those programs. And we have a budget of about $4.2 million. We have a very dynamic board of directors who's guiding helps guide the organization, 14 board members comprised of Haitian, non-Haitian people, but mostly people who are just passionate about making an impact in Haiti. And so our organization is really focused on accomplishing our vision. So what's our vision? Our vision is joyful children, it's healthy families, it's thriving communities, and it's the resources to make that so.
How often do you go to Haiti?
I go to Haiti about every, I'd say, 8 weeks.
But how have you seen it change and evolve over the last? I mean, I'm wondering what kind of Haiti people who may not have been there for the past 8 years might go home to.
Well, I think they're going to go home to a place with a lot more opportunity, with a young generation of people who are out there hustling, trying to create new startups and trying to do business and focusing on positive ways to improve the country. So I think that I will say this before, even in those days where I said that, you know, we were very positive about the direction of the country and people who are interested in the country were optimistic. I don't remember there being as much economic activity and as much interest in helping the country succeed economically through startups, through, you know, tech summits, through social and economic business investments and loans and grants. So that seems to be a lot more prevalent. And so there's opportunity there. There's opportunity to do great things and help people improve their own lives. And there's opportunity to do business and create jobs and help the economy.
I just find it to be interesting, the difference between when I talk with you and when I talk with people who have been in Haiti for a number of years, I mean, decades, they have a much rosier picture to paint than what comes through in the headlines. It seems like only the negative stuff gets through.
Yeah, no, it really is something that we fight against, because we want the narrative to be balanced, and we want people to know the heroes in Haiti, and those heroes are the Haitian people, the doctors, the nurses, the educators, who are committed to a better way of life, and in the face of some pretty significant challenges.
That was Hope for Haiti CEO Skylar Badenoch talking about a feeling of optimism on the ground in Haiti.
And getting at those real stories of people here in Southwest Florida is what the Where is Home project is all about. We'll be talking with people from various circumstances about the impending end of TPS, how they're planning, and how they feel about where, in fact, their home is.
We'll also be compiling data on how Haitian TPS holders have impacted the area, not only financially by working and paying taxes, but also the cultural influences and daily life philosophy they bring with them and share with their neighbors and coworkers. If you'd like to become part of the story or just learn more, connect with us online at wgcunews.org/where is home.
That's all the time we have for today's show. Our show was produced by Mike Canary, Julie Glenn, and myself, John Davis. Our director is Richard Chinqui. Our social media coordinator is Tara Callaghan.
Gulf Coast Live is made possible through the generous support of the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. For now, thanks for listening. I'm Julie Glenn. This is WGCU-FM Fort Myers, 90.1, WMKO Marco Island, 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida. Whoa, oh, oh.